Good evening and welcome to the KRFP Evening Report for Monday, February 17th, 2020. I'm Lee Robertus in the news tonight. Idaho House passes Heather Scott's anti-affirmative action bill 55-15, which would ban preferential treatment based on gender and race in hiring and government contracts. Oregon Governor Kate Brown calls Lower Snake River Dam breaching the most robust solution for salmon survival. In letter to Washington, Governor Jay Inslee, and appeals running out for Idaho death row inmate. We'll have details on those stories and more coming up on the KRFP Evening Report. And live in the KRFP studios in Moscow, Idaho, I'm Lee Robertus, and this is the KRFP Evening Report. The Idaho House voted 55-15 today in favor of a bill from Republican Representative Heather Scott of Blanchard that would modify the Idaho Human Rights Act to ban affirmative action for women and minorities in state or local government hiring, contracting, or public education. The Idaho Press website reports the vote was nearly party line. The State Human Rights Act already bans discrimination against people based on race, color, religion, or gender, but does not address preferential treatment. For nearly a decade, Idahoans have been swarming the state capitol every year to get the legislature to add sexual orientation and gender identity to the Human Rights Act. Scott's bill does not address those issues. Under Scott's bill, it would still be legal to give preferential treatment in hiring and contracting based on religious affiliation. Responding to a question from Democratic Representative Muffy Davis of Ketchum, who uses a wheelchair, as to why the bill does not include disabilities, Scott said during debate on the House floor today, the bill only includes immutable traits. She said, these are traits that you cannot hide. In some people, you can see disability as you look at them, and in some people, you cannot, and that is not considered an immutable trait. Democratic Representative John Gannon of Boise told lawmakers the bill is about inequality. Gannon said it abolishes affirmative action for some and affirms discrimination for others. That is discrimination, to say that you're only going to outlaw discrimination in certain instances. In fact, the list in this bill in paragraph 1 doesn't include disability, it doesn't include religion, it doesn't include sexual orientation. It's very limited. And it implies that, hey, discriminating on the basis of religion, sexual orientation, or disability, hey, that's okay under this bill. This is nothing but a discrimination bill. It is an inequality bill, and I urge you to reject this bill. Republican Representatives Bill Gosling of Moscow and Carolyn Troy of Genesee voted in favor of the bill, which now heads to the Senate. The only Republican who voted against Scott's bill was Representative Fred Wood of Burley. During last week's House State Affairs Committee hearing on the bill, most of the testimony was against the bill, but the committee passed it 12-3 along party lines. Here's a sample of the testimony against Heather Scott's bill from last week, starting with Reverend Sarah Walal of the Boise Unitarian Universalist Church, and followed by Planned Parenthood State Director for Idaho, Misty Tallman.
As a Unitarian Universalist, we uphold the principles and values of justice, equity, and compassion, and I stand in opposition in this bill today because I don't believe it upholds those ideals. Instituting this bill would effectively limit opportunities for those with the most marginalized identities. Because while we wish that our systems and institutions were not biased, they are. And research has shown that we human beings also hold deep implicit bias. And we've watched that play out in harmful ways in our society. We've watched people of color and women be overlooked for positions because of their identity and not because of their merit or skills. So we need programs and policies that allow those that have faced historic systemic discrimination to achieve their goals and thrive equally. We need policies that help level that playing field that has been unlevel for so long. I know that without affirmative action policies and programs, I might not have gotten into graduate school. I know that certainly I would not hold the job that I hold now that was largely and historically dominated by men. Though I do know that I was equally qualified and possessed the same skills and merits as my male counterparts. All Idahoans deserve the opportunity to thrive equally. They deserve our support to access those opportunities equally.
My name is Misty Tolman. I'm the State Director for Planned Parenthood in Idaho, and we are here today to oppose House Bill 440. Planned Parenthood provides high-quality, evidence-based sexual and reproductive health care to patients in Idaho and across the country. Our mission is to support the health and wellness of all Idahoans, and we're committed to reducing health disparities and promoting health equity for all the communities that we serve. This includes addressing social determinants of health, like access to education, housing, and equitable workplaces, so that all people can have the opportunity to thrive. That's why we stand here in opposition of House Bill 440. Marginalized communities across the country are increasingly targeted, and marginalized groups in Idaho have been fighting for years to receive basic protections, such as the basic right of LGBTQ Idahoans to access housing and employment without discrimination. But at this critical time, our legislature continues to ignore these communities and is now attempting to roll back existing protections. Affirmative action promotes inclusion and is designed to give everybody an equal chance to compete. These important protections help level the playing field of economic, educational, and employment opportunities, and help to ensure that race, gender, and national origin are not barriers to success for Idahoans. Eliminating these protections will make it harder for Idahoans disadvantaged by their background to compete and participate equally. 42 states currently allow affirmative action, and affirmative action is supported by business leaders, the U.S. military, educational institutions across the country, and the majority of Americans. Instead of banning popular and effective policies that promote equal opportunity, we encourage you to focus on legislation that will meaningfully promote the health and well-being of Idahoans.
That was Planned Parenthood State Director for Idaho, Misty Tolman. And before that, you heard from Reverend Sarah Wallal of the Boise Unitarian Universalist Church. They're speaking at last week's House State Affairs Committee meeting, hearing on Representative Heather Scott's bill that would ban some forms of affirmative action. During last week's State Affairs Committee meeting, Chair Stephen Harris of Meridian repeatedly shut down discussion of the constitutionality of Heather Scott's bill. Democratic Representative John Gannon of Boise tried to ask about the constitutionality of the bill in light of recent U.S. Supreme Court decisions regarding discrimination based on sexual orientation or gender identity. Each time Representative Gannon brought up that subject, Committee Chair Stephen Harris of Meridian ruled the question out of order. Gannon also made a motion for the committee to vote on whether Representative Harris incorrectly ruled his question out of order, and Harris replied, "That is not a valid motion. So that is not accepted. It's out of order. It's not a valid motion." Heather Scott is a far-right elected official allied with Republican Representative Matt Shea of Spokane Valley, who serves in the Washington legislature. Although Scott's bills are readily accepted in the Idaho legislature, the Washington House Republican caucus has kicked out Matt Shea after a report from an investigative firm hired by legislators found Shea participated in acts of domestic terrorism in December 2015 when he helped plan the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge takeover, which occurred in early 2016. The report by the Ramparts Group also mentioned Heather Scott numerous times. Scott visited the Malheur Wildlife Refuge armed occupiers, as did Shea. Scott and Shea were also leaders of COWS, or Coalition of Western States, which the Ramparts report says instigated the occupation. Scott, who is allied with the Redoubt movement, is also known for parading proudly with a large Confederate flag in her Timber Days parade float in northern Idaho in 2015, shortly after white supremacist Dylan Roof celebrated the Confederate flag and then killed 9 black churchgoers in South Carolina.
A change to how public assistance programs weigh on a person's citizenship application is shaking Idaho's immigrant community. What's known as the public charge rule will allow the Department of Homeland Security to penalize potential citizens for their use of public benefits, like Medicaid and food assistance. It could even factor into denying them citizenship. After a U.S. Supreme Court ruling last month, the new regulation will go into effect February 24th. But Sam Bird with Idaho's Centro de Comunidad y Justicia says the rule sowed fear as soon as it was floated in 2018.
The impact on the community was instant. In other words, it isn't happening now as a result of what has been passed. It happened when it was proposed.
Bird says some people have given up the benefits they qualify for because of the new rule, noting that about 18,000 U.S. citizens have left the Children's Health Insurance Program since the announcement. The Trump administration says it's protecting taxpayers and wants to ensure that people applying for citizenship are self-sufficient. Byrd says fear of the public charge rule has put his organization and others that provide community services for immigrants in a tough position. He says Comunidad y Justicia is focusing on two priorities. The first is letting people who are eligible know that they can continue using these programs.
The other one is that we have to look at, okay, what other alternatives are we going to have at the community level to be able to respond to those children and those family members that are going to get sick and that are not going to seek help.
Of the 540,000 people who apply for green cards in the U.S. each year, roughly 380,000 could be subject to review under this change, according to research by the Associated Press. For Northern Rockies News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
The Idaho Senate voted 20-13 today to kill a bill from Democratic Senator Cherie Buckner-Webb of Boise that would guarantee Idaho women have access to 6-month prescriptions for birth control instead of 1 or 3 month prescriptions. All 17 of the bill's co-sponsors in the Senate and House were Democrats. Buckner-Webb said, "This is a great opportunity for the women of our state. It's a medical issue. We are only talking about birth control." She said many insurance companies are already offering 6-month prescriptions because the market demands it. Republicans expressed concern the bill would apply to drug-induced abortion pills, although it's unclear how a 6-month prescription would be an issue for the so-called next-day pills. Republican Senator Kelly Anthon of Burley said he didn't have a problem with the 6-month supply, but he said he does object when the government inserts itself into a private contract. In related news, Senator Cherie Buckner-Webb announced today she will not seek re-election. Buckner-Webb is the only African-American in the Idaho legislature. She said in a statement, "It has been an honor to serve the state of Idaho and its citizens during my 10 years in the Idaho legislature, 2 years in the House and 8 years in the Senate. It has been an extraordinary time in my life and in the lives of all Idahoans as we have watched phenomenal transformation in our state, our increasing population, our new businesses and industries, and all of the benefits and problems of a rapidly growing state. Those benefits and problems are not evenly distributed, and it is the responsibility of Idaho's citizen legislature to ensure that all Idahoans are valued and heard." You're tuned into the KRFP Evening Report. This is KRFP Bosco Pullman.
Findings that child sexual abuse reports in Idaho went up in 2019 have made headlines, but advocates for child welfare say more reports could be a good sign. The Idaho Attorney General's annual report says there were 696 reported cases of child sexual abuse in 2019, up 103 from 2018. But Holly Whitworth with Eastern Idaho Public Health says a rise in reported cases doesn't mean more cases are happening. In fact, she says reports could be rising because more people are willing to come forward and speak about abuse.
The medical community, law enforcement, judicial, faith-based congregations, and service congregations, and including our schools and educators, they're talking more about it, and they're receiving more training about it. And I think that that's one of the reasons why you've seen this spike in the amount of cases.
Whitworth notes child sexual abuse is an underreported crime, meaning the 696 cases in Idaho last year are a fraction of the total number of cases that happened. Whitworth says it's important for adults to understand how they can prevent sexual abuse. The first step is knowing who is perpetrating it. She says in the overwhelming majority of cases, it is someone parents or guardians of a child know.
So that tells us that parents need to remain watchful of the people that their children are spending time with, especially those that are in a position of trust.
Whitworth says it's important for adults to speak with their children about abuse and signs of abuse. She also points people toward Darkness to Light's Stewards of Children program, a statewide effort that offers training on prevention of child sexual abuse. For Northern Rockies News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
The Idaho Legislature's Joint Finance Appropriations Committee last week voted unanimously to adopt raises the legislature's Joint Change in Employee Compensation Committee earlier recommended. The merit raises for state employees would average 2% during the next fiscal year, which begins July 1st. The raises are expected to cost the state's general fund $13.9 million. The Joint Committee also approved 2% base salary increases for public school classified staff and administrators who are not on the teacher career ladder pay schedules. The committee voted 17-1 last week to approve Governor Brad Little's one-time budget rescission for all state departments, meaning departments may have to lay off or offer early retirements to employees. Democratic Representative Melissa Wintrow of Boise was the dissenting vote. University of Idaho President C. Scott Green has said 100 UI employees have already agreed to accept early retirement offers. The Washington House passed a bill Friday allowing the media to have access to state and local government employees' birth dates, but not the general public. The bill passed 91-7 and now heads to the Senate. The bill comes after the state Supreme Court ruled 5-4 in October there is no statutory or constitutional allowance to prevent the release of the birth dates. The Conservative Freedom Foundation had asked for records on public employees who are members of unions to aid in their efforts to destroy or reduce the influence of public sector unions. Lawmakers say they want to protect state employees from identity theft, stalkers, and others. The bill would require state and local government agencies to notify employees and their unions when there is a request for employee information. 64-year-old Idaho death row inmate Gerald Pizzuto is running out of appeal options, meaning Idaho correction officials might start planning for his execution by the end of the year. Pizzuto was convicted in 1986 of beating prospectors 58-year-old Berta Herndon and her nephew 37-year-old Del Herndon to death in the Idaho County backcountry. Pizzuto bound the victims and bludgeoned both of them and shot Del Herndon. Last year, a 3-judge panel of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals upheld a lower court's ruling which found Pizzuto could not claim to be intellectually disabled. His attorneys asked the full Ninth Circuit Court to make an en banc ruling on the matter, and they declined. Pizzuto's attorneys now have until March 30th to file a petition with the U.S. Supreme Court to consider the case. Pizzuto's attorneys are also preparing to file a petition for clemency with the Idaho Commission on Pardons and Parole to change the death sentence to a life in prison sentence. It has been difficult for states to purchase execution drugs in recent years as more and more pharmaceutical manufacturers refuse to sell them. The Associated Press reports Correction Department spokesperson Jeff Ray wrote in an email Friday, IDOC does not speculate about the possible execution of any inmate prior to the issuance of a death warrant. We are confident that when the time comes, we will have the means to carry out an execution. In 2017, University of Idaho researcher Elisa Cover and the ACLU sued the Correction Department in an attempt to get them to release information about the execution drugs the state used to kill inmates Paul Ezra Rhodes and Richard Levitt. The lawsuit has not secured the release of the documents yet, but in September, District Judge Lynn Norton ordered a new trial in the case. At the time, ACLU of Idaho legal director Richie Epping said, "We'll go to trial and once again prove that secrecy around lethal injection in particular is harmful to the public interest." Democratic Oregon Governor Kate Brown has written to Washington Governor Jay Inslee, also a Democrat, saying breaching the four lower Snake River dams in southeastern Washington is the best way to assure survival of salmon and steelhead in the Columbia River Basin. Governor Brown's letter said science has already made clear that the, quote, most certain and robust solution to Snake River salmon and steelhead recovery, unquote, is removal of the dams. The four lower Snake River dams are Lower Granite Dam east of Pullman, Little Goose Dam, Lower Monumental Dam, and Ice Harbor Dam near Tri-Cities. Chinook salmon from the Columbia watershed are a critical food source for 75 southern resident orca whales remaining on the planet. Brown's letter angered Republican lawmakers, who said they will wait for the conclusion of another federal environmental study of the Columbia and Snake River hydrosystems, quote, before jumping to conclusions that would devastate our regional economy and local communities, including those in Oregon. Republican U.S. Representatives Kathy McMorris Rogers, Dan Newhouse, and Jamie Herrera Butler, all of Washington, said in a joint statement, this is yet another example of state officials trying to interfere in the operation of critical federal infrastructure. When U.S. Federal Judge Michael Simon in Portland ordered the latest multi-agency federal study, he stipulated the study must include breaching the four lower Snake River dams as an option. According to the Tri-City Herald, Pacific Northwest Waterways Association Executive Director Kristen Mira said, it is surprising to see a letter of this nature expressing a position for the state of Oregon for an extreme approach on the river system prior to the release of the federal agency's proposed operations. Save Our Wild Salmon Inland Northwest Director Sam Mace said in an interview published in yesterday's print edition of the Spokesman Review, economic studies show that a restored river would bring hundreds of millions of dollars into our regional economy and rural towns. Let's imagine Clarkston and Lewiston with a revitalized, free-flowing waterfront. Mace also said the continued Puget Sound orca deaths and struggling salmon and steelhead runs have made the need for real action ever more urgent. We now know our orcas feed on Columbia salmon and that our best shot at getting starving whales more food is restoring the Snake River. People across the region are calling for action to save these Northwest icons. Closer to home, the loss of fishing seasons has hit outfitters and rural towns hard. People in these communities are stepping up to defend their livelihoods. The Moscow City Council will hold a stormwater workshop tomorrow afternoon, which will include a presentation by Aspect Consulting. The special workshop meeting includes staff comments and information from Deputy City Supervisor Tyler Palmer and Environmental Services Manager Kyle Steele. The meeting will begin at 4:30 p.m. The council will meet again tomorrow at 7 p.m. for their regular meeting. One agenda item is approval of a $150,000 post-disaster grant application to the Idaho Commerce Department to pay for a bridge replacement over Paradise Creek on East 6th Street. The bridge, located near Mountain View Road, sustained significant erosion damage that undermined the roadway shoulders during the flood event of April of last year. Another agenda item is approval of the purchase of BS&A Enterprise Resource Planning Software to replace the city's current resource planning software. City Council meetings are being held Tuesday this week because of the President's Day holiday. And you're tuned in to the KRFP Evening Report. Here on KRFP, Moscow Pullman will be back in a moment.
KRFP is supported by listeners like you and Rembrandt Tree Care, family owned and operated since 1977. A conscientious approach to urban forestry with year-round tree service on the Palouse and surrounding areas. You can reach Rembrandt Tree Care at 509-330-0699.
KRFP thanks all of its donors and underwriters for helping make this programming possible.
This is the KRFP Evening Report. We now turn to our featured segment, Washington State University Biochemistry and Basic Medical Sciences. Professor Emeritus Martin Paul gave an audience of about 40 a thorough rundown of the scientific research showing significant health risks from the rollout of 5G wireless technology on February 5th at the University of Idaho Law School courtroom. The Palouse Area Citizens for Safe Electricity and the Palouse Environmental Sustainability Coalition organized the talk. To Paul, the biggest red flag right off the bat is the fact that the telecom industry and the Federal Communications Commission have no biological testing data on 5G. On the February 7th and February 14th evening report, we broadcast extended excerpts from Martin Paul's talk. Those segments are archived on the KRFP website. Here's a third segment of Dr. Paul's talk.
Another kind of pulse has also been studied here. These are called nanosecond pulses. And they're defined as pulses between 1 nanosecond and 1 microsecond in length. And what are they? These are pure pulses. They're just things that go up and come down. So these are not modulating pulses. These are just pure pulses. And you get a pulse between 1 nanosecond and 1 microsecond. And there are many, many studies that have shown these pulses produce effects. Now, if you take a typical, let's say, 40 nanosecond pulse, and you average it over 6 minutes, you're averaging it over approximately 10 to the 10th, or 10 billion times longer. Okay, so the safety guidelines, again, they say you should average everything over 6 minutes. So we average this over 6 minutes. What does this do? It takes an intensity, average intensity, is way up in the stratosphere, and it drops it down to the floor. And what happens then? Well, the industry predicts, well, it can't possibly do anything. But these things do produce effects over and over and over and over again. So it makes no sense to take a pulse that produces effects and average its intensity over 10 billion times longer. It makes absolutely no sense to do that, but that's what they do. I liken the logic here, if I can use that term, to the following kind of thing. Let's say I'm afraid of a high-powered rifle bullet traveling over 700 meters per second. And that rifle bullet needs about 50 microseconds to, I say, injure my body, actually. It does more than that, as you can well imagine. So let's say you go to the regulatory agency, say, I'm afraid of this rifle bullet, and they come back and say, well, you don't have to worry about it if you average the bullet's force over 10 billion times longer, which is about 75 days. The force is so weak, it can't do anything. Now, that's the kind of logic that these agencies are using, and it's absolutely insane. But this is what's going on. I mean, this makes no sense whatsoever. And how anybody can make these arguments is just bizarre. So anyway, this is another type of evidence then that shows safety guidelines do not predict biological effects and therefore do not predict safety. There are also studies that have been done on pairs of nanosecond pulses, which occur within a few microseconds of each other. And let me say, I think I understand how these things work, but I don't think I have time to talk about how they work. If you have two pulses of identical polarity, they produce super additive effects. They produce much higher effects than the sum of the two effects of the individual ones. If, on the other hand, the second pulse has opposite polarity, it actually cancels much of the effect of the first pulse. You get a lower effect than you get with the first pulse alone. Now, neither of these things are consistent with the predictions of safety guidelines, which assume that you only have additive effects, average effects. There's another thing, actually, that this shows, and I won't spend too much time on this, but basically, the way in which the safety guidelines average these things, they're averaging them as if they were scalars, that is, things that have intensity but no direction. But in fact, these are vectors. They have direction, and they have polarity, and those are both important. And so you can't just average them. So the physics and in fact the mathematics of what they're doing is bogus in these safety guidelines. Now, one thing I want to say here is, you know, 5G, the pulses are not these. By the way, these nanosecond pulses also work via VGCC activation. They all do the same thing. VGCC activation, the modulating pulses also work via VGCC activation. And so when you have a full-fledged 5G system communicating with what they say, the Internet of Things, you're inevitably going to have trillions and trillions of these pulses. They're not going to be these kind of pulses. They're going to be modulating pulses and hundreds of billions of pairs of pulses. And so you're going to get huge effects, none of which are predicted by the safety guidelines. So, there are three more flaws. I think I'm just going to talk about two of them. One of them is that there are a lot of studies, and there are 9 reviews of this, where there are certain intensity regions, they're called windows, where you get maximum effects. So you have a particular kind of EMF, and within a certain intensity range, they produce huge, very large effects. When the intensities go lower or higher, they drop way down. So you can have maximum effects in an intensity window, and you can go up like in one study it was done, they went up to intensities that were 150 times higher. And the effects were still much, much, much lower than you got in the window. What does this tell you? It tells you that these are not totally nonlinear. They are almost inherently unpredictable. And so trying to use a simple model where they assume that higher intensities are always more dangerous and that you can predict effects as a consequence of this, of the safety guideline, is total nonsense. We do not have any simple way of predicting biological effects from any simple model, period. Now that doesn't mean, you know, in the future maybe we can develop some model that might be able to be predictive, but at this point we don't have any. Now, there's another kind of thing, and that is there are a whole bunch of studies that have been done where specific research groups have studied different cell types. So we have many, many different types of cells in our bodies. When you look at different cell types, they respond very differently to the same EMFs measured in the same way under the same conditions. Different cells respond differently. What does this tell you? You cannot ignore the biological heterogeneity that's inherent in the system. But that's exactly what the safety guidelines do. So every single time you look at these guidelines, they fail and fail massively to predict biological effects, and therefore they have to be thrown out. Now, and this goes now to the heart of the scientific method. Right at the core of the scientific method is this is that when you have a theory, and it, of course, all scientific theories must make testable predictions, and you test those predictions, and the predictions fail, what do? You throw the theory out. What does the industry do? What do the regulatory agencies do? Yeah, they're blind. They completely ignore all of these things. And so what we have here, and it's absolutely clear, is we've got a multi-trillion dollar set of companies, the telecommunications industries, all of whose claims of safety are based on these failed safety guidelines and are therefore fraudulent. This is the world we live in. Not very long. Now, there are four reasons why children are more sensitive to EMFs than adults. And they have higher surface to volume ratios, and their tissues are more exposed as a consequence. Children have very high density of stem cells. Stem cells are very, very sensitive to EMFs. So I just mentioned there's a lot of variation in different cell types. What do we got? We have stem cells that, so children, the younger they are, the higher the density of stem cells. So that's a problem. There's special problems with the developing brain, young tissues have much greater extracellular water content than older tissues, and these have all been talked about before, this one by Deborah Davis and this one by Igor Belyaev. So there are four reasons why children are more sensitive, there are other probable biological effects, including Alzheimer's, very early onset Alzheimer's and other dementias, including autism and ADHD. I'll talk about those at the end if I have time, and electromagnetic hypersensitivity. And let me say, some of these effects, quite a number of these effects, are cumulative. And as they become more severe, they become essentially irreversible. And I don't really have time to go through these, but there are a number of them. And I believe that these are caused by changes in the tissues, in the structure of the tissues. We talked about before that the testis and the ovary are impacted. The brain is also impacted. The heart is impacted. Where you get changes in the structure of the tissues. And there are other tissues that are sometimes impacted as well. So one of the problems we have here is that with many of the exposures we've had in the past, they produce effects relatively slowly, and which means we're not aware of them. But they've been studied, they've been measured, and we know they are occurring. So it's these slowly developing things that are things that, you know, people say, well, I don't see anything. We are much less aware of these slowly developing things than we are of things that occur very rapidly. Okay. Now, let's talk about 5G. Um, 5G, as I said before, is designed to be extraordinarily highly pulsed, and that's very problematic for the reasons that we've already stated. They're also plan to have extraordinary numbers of 5G antennae in close proximity to essentially everywhere, homes, schools, hospitals, businesses. That has great implications. And it makes it essentially impossible to avoid the extraordinary high levels of these pulsed exposures, combination of these two. 5G millimeter waves do produce penetrating effects. So the industry claims that you cannot get penetrating effects. They claim that the electrical parts of the millimeter waves, which is the frequency to be used in 5G. Are absorbed in the outer 1 millimeter of the body, and therefore you can't get effects deeper in the body. We know, in fact, that's not true, and we know that because millimeter waves have been studied, you know, 20, 30, 40 years ago and have shown to be able to produce effects, including effects in the human brain and effects in animals, in internal organs in animals. So these have been shown, and let me just say, in order to affect the human brain, what does it have to do? It has to go through the hair, the skin, the skull, and the meninges to cover the brain, right? And so obviously you're getting effects in the human brain. You're not just limited, you're not just having effects in the outer 1 millimeter of the body, but that's what the industry claims. You cannot get more penetrating effects. I don't know whether I'm going to tell you about how this works, but it does work. And so you do get very high surface effects from 5G. But you also get very important, highly penetrating effects. And so, for example, you can get sudden cardiac death in rats from millimeter waves. That was shown decades ago. And so it penetrates into the heart. So that again shows that the industry claim is simply false. So we have this extraordinary level of pulsation. We have extraordinary numbers. We have the human exposure was estimated in this paper to be about 30 times higher than is produced by our current antennae. I'm sure if you ask the industry, they'll tell you this paper is wrong. But then they tell you a lot of things are wrong that where they're not wrong. Pulse the rays are used, what are called phase the rays are used to increase the penetration into buildings, and this produces still more pulsation. So phase the rays are things that are used by radar, and they're also used in 5G to get much more penetrating effects into buildings. Of course, that produces much more penetrating effects into our bodies as well. So, so there are lots and lots of problems here. And as I said before, we need biological safety testing. We're not getting it. So these are some of the studies that show that millimeter waves, in fact, produce penetrating effects in the body. So I do have something on this slide about how this works, and I don't think I'm going to spend the time to talk about it. So what are we actually seeing with 5G? The human effects reported in Switzerland and in Stuttgart, Germany. In Switzerland, they have found widespread neurological and neuropsychiatric effects and also cardiac effects. So these are the sorts that we discussed before. In Stuttgart, Germany, there have been protests by physicians because of the effects they are seeing in their patients, which are unprecedented. And they again are seeing widespread neurological and neuropsychiatric effects and cardiac effects. They're also seeing very large increases in electromagnetic hypersensitivity, EHS, in Stuttgart, Germany. So these are all very important findings, and you can look these up in these news articles that I've got listed here. Some of them are in English or some are in German, but you can always run things through Google Translate if you have to. Now, these effects that are seen in Switzerland and in Stuttgart, Germany, are very similar to the effects that have been found by Lamech and also by Conrad following exposure to smart meter pulses. And they're also very similar, but they're more severe than those. They're also similar, but much more severe than the occupational EMF exposures that were that were reviewed by Professor Carl Hecht. So we have, you know, we know from these other studies that other kinds of EMFs can produce very similar effects. These effects, as I say, are more severe than we're seeing then, but they're similar in kind. Let me just say one other thing. I just want to remind you of something. The effects that you see on the initial rollout of 5G are only a tiny, tiny fraction of what you will see with any mature 5G system communicating with billions of different devices, which is, of course, what they are touting this to be. So even though these are very severe, they in no way tell you about the severity of what a full-fledged 5G system will do. Anyway, and I have a reminder of what kinds of neuropsychiatric effects we see all the time. Many of these are shown to occur in Switzerland and in Stuttgart, Germany.
And that was Washington State University Biochemistry and Basic Medical Sciences Professor Emeritus Martin Paul speaking on scientific research showing significant health risks from the rollout of 5G wireless technology, February 5th at the University of Idaho Law School courtroom. Dr. Paul will also be speaking at Gonzaga University on Thursday, February 27th at the Gonzaga University John J. Hemmingson Conference Center. And he'll be speaking also with WSU Electrical Engineering Professor Emeritus Dr. Robert Olson, who is a critic of Dr. Paul's interpretation of some of the dangers of 5G wireless and also a member of the Pullman Planning Commission. That will take place at 4 p.m. Thursday, February 27th in Spokane at Gonzaga University at the John J. Hemmingson Conference Center. Well, that's it for the KRFP Evening Report for tonight. Taking a look at the weather forecast for the Moscow-Pullman area, it's going to be mostly clear through Thursday with a low of 23 tonight, highs 38 tomorrow and Wednesday, and 42 on Thursday, lows around 22 Tuesday and Wednesday night. Currently 33 degrees. If you want to help KRFP keep newscasts like this on the air, plus the newscasts you hear during Morning Mix, the recordings of local events and the public affairs shows, plus the music and arts programming you hear every day on KRFP, be sure to become a member of KRFP. Memberships are $35 a year, $20 for students and low income. You can mail your memberships to KRFP, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. That's KRFP, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843, or you can go to the KRFP website to find out more ways to help KRFP. I'm Lee Robartis, and coming up next is Flashpoints, the daily investigative news magazine from Pacifica Radio, and at 7:30 we will have Disability Talk Northwest live in the studios with music and news about disability issues. So that's all coming up. Stay tuned for more KRFP Moscow Pullman.
KRFP is a non-commercial community radio station that airs underwriting messages as a cost-effective way to let listeners know your business supports community radio. To sign up for underwriting spots, go to the KRFP website or visit the station at 114 East 3rd Street and pick up an underwriter's form.